Thanks for listening to the Suzy Larson Life podcast, available thanks to support from listeners like you. It's only just a matter of welcome to Suzy Larson Live. Always so honored to get to spend this time with you. In fact, I look forward to bringing you conversations every single day that hopefully inspire you in your faith walk, that deepen your understanding of God's Word, and that heightens your awareness of His very real presence in your life. Well, a few months ago, I was at a wedding with my friend Shannon Velzer. We were sitting next to each other, and you may know that name because she's been on the show a few times when we've done the intercessor panel. Well, she leaned over and whispered something to me. She said, "I have someone that you need to have on your show." She said, "His story is unbelievable, and his message is critical to the church. The church needs to hear what he has to say." Well, this man's pastor wrote these words about my guest today. He says, "We don't have many heroes today. We have celebrities, but not many heroes. Typically, celebrities aren't known because of their character, but because of their exposure. They're celebrated because they've been on TV or gone viral. Heroes, on the other hand, are known for character. And that's very different from celebrity. Character has a journey to it, a journey of pain and making it to the other side. Kevin is such a hero. A fight to forgive is such a journey, full of facing unknowns, twists, and eventually the lessons of healing, forgiveness, and purpose that God had to teach Kevin in the wake of what happened on August 4th, 2009. Kevin Ramsby joins me today to share his story and draw from his book, A Fight to Forgive, How to Turn Their Wrongs and Your Hurts into God's Greater Purposes. We'll draw from his story and from his book. I want to say the first part of the show, when Kevin tells his story, it's not suitable for young ears. It will be hard to hear the first part of this story, but you'll be blown away by God's power to redeem. So you got to hang with us. And if you're maybe in the car for a short time and then you got to get out, go back once the live show is over and catch the podcast, okay? We got a handful of copies of Kevin's book, A Fight to Forgive. It reads like a novel. I couldn't put it down. Subtitle is How to Turn Their Wrongs and Your Hurts into God's Greater Purposes. If you feel kind of stuck in your trauma or even in your grudge holding because of some kind of offense and it's affecting your life and others around you would say so, this is a great book for you because you'll not only be gripped by the story, but there's practical application about how to sort through your trauma, sort through what happened, name it, acknowledge it, and then walk it through with God so you can get to the other side where the enemy does not get the last say on your painful parts of your story. You can text the word book to 877-933-2484. Quick announcement before we hear from Kevin. I learned something today. So you know those audio clips that I recorded, 15 of them, they're about 2 to 3 minutes long, on the presence of God, on the love of God, on a prayer for you. If you text closer, you start at the beginning. So there's 15 of them, but you can text, I thought, you know, wherever you started in the middle of the month, basically, you get what's left. But no, if you text today, the word closer, you'll get the series just scattered out a few a week, sent to your phone, just a 2-3 minute message on the presence of God, on the love of God, on the nearness of God. And if you just need a little reminder, a short audio devo from me to send to your phone, just text the word closer to 877-933-2484. Now, let me tell you about my guest. We'll get him on the show. With more than 30 years of leadership experience in diverse and multicultural settings, Kevin Ramsby is a leading voice in the field of forgiveness, overcoming trauma, and reconciliation. His message is truly inspiring, born from his experience of surviving a home invasion while pastoring in Detroit's inner city. Kevin's message is impacting tens of thousands of people every month through various ministry expressions and resources, from inmates on death row to leaders and members of the church at large. Kevin's message is reaching people in all walks of life. Dear Kevin, so nice to meet you. Welcome to the program.
Thank you so much. Excited to be here with you.
Looking forward to the conversation. And let's start with this. What's the Lord been talking to you about these days?
You know what? I've been really digging into worship lately. It's kind of random, out of the blue. And I think it's just, we're getting ready to do a ministry trip and we're talking about trauma and was really trying to figure out what should our response be to trauma? You know, they normally talk about, fleeing or fighting or freezing. And I kind of came across this verse and it really, I added a fourth one, which was fall, which was to me became worship. And so kind of went on a rabbit trail, went to the first time the word worship is used in scriptures, and it's in Genesis 22, which with Abraham when he's ready to sacrifice his son Isaac, and you know, and God asks him to take him to this mountain that he doesn't know where he's supposed to go to, and he's going to offer his son as a sacrifice. And when he's on his way going there, there came this moment where those that were traveling with him, he said, "We're going. You guys stay here. Me and the lad are going to go up to the mountain, and we're going to worship, and then we'll come back." And it just caught me. I was like, "Going, man, what a task to be charged with, to offer your son that you love, to let go of something that you dearly love, or has become part of your life, a major part." And so he goes in and worship. And when I was just digging into the word worship, the word meant to fall down. And then it was just kind of triggered me. And I was just like, man, I was like, that's, you know, I think of worship nowadays, you go into church and you're singing the songs and people are drinking coffee, and it's a casual individual experience. But it just, something stuck out to me that the first use of the word worship was to fall. And then it kind of led beautiful. Me to, you know, Matthew, where it talks about, you know, our Father's looking for those who will worship him in spirit and in truth. And so I just looked up in the Greek, you know, what does it mean to worship there? What are the type of worship? What does that mean? And it came across, it said to kiss the hand to one. It talked about to fall upon the knees and touch the ground with the forehead, by kneeling to prostrate, to pay homage to, or to honor someone. And I was just like, I just really saw that worship is more than songs. It's really a posture. And really impacted me. And I've really, in my morning devotion and prayer times, I've now began to implement the practice of, instead of just singing songs or worshiping with my words, to really make worship about a posture of whether it's getting on my knees and face before the Lord. And it's just, I tell you what, it's made my devotional life and just my prayer time so more such a greater intimacy in it, just by assuming that posture. So it's kind of something the Lord's been working with me on.
Well, someone needed to hear that today, Kevin. It's just beautiful because, you know, the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and we honor and revere him as he deserves. And as you say, we posture ourselves before him because he's worthy of it. I feel like something changes in us, you know, and I think that's someone needed to hear that today. And if that's you, text me an amen. If you needed to hear that, in fact, maybe tomorrow morning or tonight, whenever you have your devotional time, try that. Start with a playlist and get on your knees and open your hands in your lap and just tell God who he is and what you feel, think about him. And Kevin, my husband's name is Kevin, and I call him Kev. So I just know I'm going to accidentally call you Kev a few times. I hope you don't mind, but just giving you the heads up there. But would you give us a little bit of backstory of what life was like before the home invasion? What were you doing? What was your marriage and family life, ministry life like?
Yeah, my wife and I, we moved to Detroit in 1997, total faith step. Matter of fact, the ministry we were going to connect with, it took us 6 or 7 months for them to say, yes, we can come, because we said we would come and work for free. We were trusting God, but they had said they had seen so many lives destroyed, pastoral couples, because of just the hard life of living in the inner city, the financial burdens and all that type of stuff, not being able to really have salaries and all that. And we moved there by faith, and God has just provided for us. And we loved it. Detroit became our home. We didn't consider ourselves missionaries, someone from the outside coming in. It was our home. We lived there. We lived in the neighborhoods. We would purchase a home, we would fix it up, make it our almost like our dream home. And so life was great. We were in what we consider probably the most enjoyable years of ministry at that time. You know, before everything happened to us, I mean, we were just felt like we were in the Lord's sweet spot for our lives. We had moved into a home, we'd spent about a year and a half renovating it. We had just moved there. I was the executive pastor at the time. And so we worked, our church was an old XXX renovated movie theater. And on one side of our church was a strip club. On the other side was a prostitute hotel, usually for transvestites. So we were right in the heart of Detroit. I lived about a mile away from there. And we loved it. Our community, our neighbors, we had a relationship with them. We would bring catfish over to the neighbor's house, feed each other when we're cooking out. And so we've loved the city of Detroit, and we were there for 24 years.
Wow. Okay. When we come back, bring us to that day when your wife was packing up with the kids, just heading home to see her parents, and you were going to get a bunch of stuff done around the house. And that's when life changed for you. I'm talking to Kevin Ramsby. His book is titled A Fight to Forgive, How to Turn Their Wrongs and Your Hurts into God's Greater Purposes. This is where the story gets graphic, hard to hear. If you've got little ones, you might want to get them busy. And as we walk through the really, really hard stuff of what Kevin has walked through, there is joy on the other side. There is redemption on the other side. But you almost have to go through the valley to see the resurrection power of God. And boy, did Kevin ever walk through a valley. More with him when we return. If you're a new listener, we want to officially welcome you with a free welcome pack gift. Request yours today at myfaithradio.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live. My guest today is Kevin Ramsby, and he's got quite a story. And he's got a ministry now to help people heal from trauma, to help people walk through really the rugged road of forgiveness. And he is no stranger to that battle. He's not asking others to do what he himself has not done. His book, A Fight to Forgive, How to Turn Their Wrongs and Your Hurts into God's Greater Purposes. You can't put it down. It reads like a novel, but it's filled with practical application too. Mark Batterson endorsed it. He's a great friend of the show. Jim Cimbala, who's been on a bunch of times, also endorsed it. And then he's got a masterclass workbook, The Forgiveness Experience, A Guided Journey to Overcoming Trauma and Wounds Caused by Others. So at this point, okay, so you're in the inner city of Detroit. So it's not really a safe area per se, but you have dwelled, decided to put your roots down there and minister in a rough part of town. And at this point, your wife and kids are headed to, I think if I remember right, her parents' home for a couple of days. Take the story from there.
Yeah. My wife went to pick up our kids, spent a week in Rockford, Illinois. It's our hometown where we're from. And so we had just finished up an outreach all week in the city. We had 300 high school students around the nation came in. We served our city and was exhausted, went to bed around midnight. And then at 3 a.m, I was awakened to the sound of breaking glass. And so upon hearing that, I jumped up and began racing down the stairs up from the second story of my home. And as I was racing down the stairs, yelling as loud as I could, "This is my house. This is my house. Get out." A man had already crawled through the window. He was armed with a large screwdriver and then the largest like knife that would be in a knife block in your kitchen. And so him running towards the sound of my voice, me running towards the sound of the glass, we suddenly crashed into each other as he raced around the corner. And all I could do was really to launch myself from the stairs to try to tackle him. Problem was, is when I was in midair, it's when I saw that he had a knife. And the first wound, he lowered it, and the first wound when I came grabbing hold of his shoulders was to my abdomen, where it was a deep, large 7-inch stab that just ripped upwards with all my momentum coming down from the steps. And from there, a fight ensued. We fought for a little while to the point where I couldn't stand any longer, fell on the ground, and you'd think the guy would just come do whatever he came to do when I was on the ground, but instead he jumped on top of me, straddled me, and then just began stabbing me over and over and over again, hitting me in my temple, all the way through my cheek, 2 times to my throat, to my chest. The neck. The worst was when there was a point in time when he was on top of me, I was able to grab hold of the blade and the knife broke into my hand. And so I began trying to defend myself with just the blade, not holding onto a handle. So that didn't go too well. But as the knife then fell out of my hand and he went to retrieve it, I just rolled over, was getting ready to try to stand back up when he jumped on my back again. And then, which were the worst stabs, where it was 10 times to the back of the head. And there was about six stabs to the base of my neck and my spine area that literally I fell flat on the ground. And I literally thought I was paralyzed. I couldn't move. I looked up, saw my black lab there. And I remember thinking, why aren't you helping me? He just asked, where's my keys? Where's the money? I told him I didn't have any. And he would go, or I told him it was in the kitchen. He'd go look. When he couldn't find him, would come back, stab me again, drag me to the kitchen. That took place a couple times until finally he had dragged me into my kitchen area, asked one more time, wanted to know where the keys or money, where the money was. And I just looked up at him. I was angry because I knew my life was probably going to be over here. And I just remember looking up at him and as loud as I could yell to say, it doesn't matter anymore because I'm dead. And I closed my eyes there and basically just began waiting to die. Well, the man went upstairs, began going through my house. And there came a point in time where I realized I was fading in and out of consciousness. And
I'm going to pause here. I mean, because, you know, in the book, I mean, we're going to be careful over the air, but the graphic nature of this, of what was happening to your internal organs, I mean, just friends, so you know how desperately terrible these wounds were. Those were, you know, present on the floor, if I could just say that. He was decimated by this man and his knife, butcher knife. And for you to get to that point where you're so stabbed so many times and he keeps coming back to you and keeps doing that to you to the point where you're like, what does it matter? Because you're bleeding out on the floor. And then, Kevin, you know, he goes upstairs. You ask God for a sign, you know, speak to me. And at first you don't hear anything. You don't sense anything. And you feel, I think, probably abandoned. But then all of a sudden there was this life review that happened. Talk about that. What was going on in your heart about, you know, being a dad and being a husband and even feeling coming under some kind of conviction. Or maybe it was condemnation. Was the enemy coming after you? I don't know. But talk about what was happening there.
It became my final prayers when I asked God to just give me a sign that he saw me. He knew this was going on. And it was the darkest moment of my life. And I just felt like God was nowhere around. And so I began praying my final prayers. My first thought went to kind of inward. And because the reality of eternity was staring me in the eyes. I knew at any second I would find out what was on the other side of this life. And it was amazing how the enemy, I really felt it was the enemy, just began to attack me with shame and guilt and began to bring up the past, my past issues of dealing with pornography and just these things that came in there and
that were years and decades old. I mean, that's just how dirty he fights, you know?
He does. It was just, here I am, my last, feeling you're breathing your last breath and I'm sitting, my mind is going back to some of those shame, that shame and guilt. And so it was there. I prayed and just, again, I trust fully in the blood of Christ and he had covered those sins. I was forgiven. And so kind of had that moment. And then I began praying for my wife and kind of reflected back how that day when she left to go visit her family, we didn't have this big argument, but we left on terms of she was just running in a race. I wanted some time and attention. I wanted her to slow down. And she just was like, I don't have time. I've got a 6-hour drive ahead of me. And so we just left off with, you know, we'll stay in touch. Just call me when you get there. We're on the road. But I'm laying there on the ground. And in my mind, I'm just thinking through, why did I not tell her I loved her that morning? And now I'm here praying and I'm asking God to do what I should have done as her husband. He would let her know how special she was and how much I loved her and prayed for her. And then I thought of my daughter who was 9 years old at the time. And I prayed that God would keep every jerk of a boy away from her. I said, God, you're going to have to become her father now because I won't be able to look out for her. And I prayed that God would protect her, her purity and keep her safe. And then I prayed my son Noah, he was 12 years old. And I knew because he was a little bit older, he could put some pieces together most likely. And so I began praying that Noah wouldn't blame God for what happened to his dad, who came to the city, moved into this area, was devoted to serving Christ, and at the end result was for him to get murdered. And as I was praying for him, it was an interruption. I literally heard four words, and they were this. They were, "They still need you." And when I heard the words, "They still need you," it went from game over to game on. I was like, I got to figure this out. And though I couldn't move seconds before and was being dragged through the house, I was able to see that he dragged me to a place in the kitchen. There was a side door to the left, down some steps, and was able to stand to my feet. And again, that's where I realized how badly I was wounded, because when I had to stand up, I had to pick up my insides that were now on my outside. And was able to make it down the steps, make it to the neighbor's house, where thankfully they were able to call 911. And then from there was there were a lot of miracles and moments happened. I later found out, not in the moment, but thankfully about a week later, I woke up in the hospital realizing that I was still there, and that life was not over, and God had given me another chance.
And this tells you what a born leader you are, because you literally stabbed 37 times, critical, critical injuries. You went on the porch of your neighbor. He didn't want to open the door because, again, it's a rough area. He's not sure who you are. You're covered in blood, but he calls 911. They come. They're so traumatized by what they see in you. They've never seen anything so bad. They freeze up and don't know what to do. And you're the one giving the orders, saying, "You pick me up at the head, you pick me up at the feet, and you guys come out from behind the door and man up. We need you to balance me." And you totally give them directions about how to get you into the ambulance. I mean, first of all, that's a natural born leader. Second of all, that's just amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it was, and I mean, literally when the guy went and opened the porch, my heart though was for my neighbor that I had never led to Christ or talked to him about. And so in my mind, I started relaying to him things to tell my son.
That's
with
right.
Hopes that he himself would come to know Christ. And but that was my heart. And it was a moment that, to me, it was really the strength of the Holy Spirit, strength of God in that moment, because there was nothing there for me. Even, you know, when they come in, they came in after the fact and they began to investigate the crime scenes. They wondered how I even made it to my neighbor's porch, because when they found me, they couldn't identify what race I was. I was 100% covered in blood, but I was only wearing shorts. They had saw that I lost consciousness, most likely, in my home.
We got a pause, got a hard break. So sorry, we're going to finish this on the other side. But imagine him on this porch. The man won't open the door. So he starts to yell out, "Tell my kids to keep following Jesus." And he's witnessing to the neighbor about following Jesus. What a story. We'll be back in a minute. Thanks so much for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live. So, Kevin Ramsby was an executive pastor in an inner city church in Detroit, and one particular weekend sent his wife and two kids to go visit her parents in Illinois. He was home alone. He was doing some household chores. He was up in his room. 3 a.m, he hears crashing glass. An intruder high on cocaine comes in. Kevin comes running down the stairs. The intruder runs towards him. They have an encounter, and this man proceeds to stab this executive pastor over and over again. And Kevin is a big guy. He's trying to fight him off, and the man kept stabbing him. And then he would go look for money, and he'd come back and stab him some more. He was stabbed 37 times. He was stabbed in the chest, stabbed in the neck, in the cheek, in the spine. At one point, when he got the the knife out of the man's hand. He severed some tendons, Kevin did, in his own hand that affected his use of his fingers. It was a nightmare. And there was a point where he was reconciling with God that he was going to die, and he was asking God to bless his son and his daughter and his wife. And he was saying his goodbyes as he was bleeding out on his kitchen floor while the man is upstairs rummaging through his bedroom trying to find money. And the Lord whispered to him, "They still need you." And he said it went from game over to game on. And somehow, even though he was stabbed throughout his body, found a way to stand up. His intestines were outside of his body. And he's holding them in his hands, stumbling out the door onto the neighbor's porch, knocking on the door covered in blood. But of course, the neighbor didn't know who this man was covered in blood. He didn't know it was his neighbor, but he called 911. At this point, the first responders come. And somehow, in the middle of that, they asked you what your wife's phone number was. I mean, I just marvel that you could rattle that off, but you're in and out of consciousness. She gets the call. When did you wake up and realize what happened? I'm sure at some point after all that trauma, your body kind of gave in and you're in multiple surgeries. When did you wake up and realize what had happened?
It was about a week later after I made it to the hospital and woke up to hearing my pastor at the time and my wife's voice. And about a week later is when I came to and realized that I'm still here and I made it.
It's just a miracle. And there's so much more to the story. And I want to make sure we get to what you have to say about trauma, recovery, and forgiveness. But we got to just talk about the aftermath, because it's so important that you didn't know this, friend listening. And you outlined this so well in the book, Kevin, that it wasn't just the trauma of that night. There was the aftermath. There was emotional, mental, physical. I mean, pain, so much pain, surgeries, financial costs, your kids were traumatized. That first they questioned your wife because she was conveniently out of town while this happens. I mean, imagine getting that call and then having to be suspect for a short time before they knew. I mean, it's just a nightmare come true. I got to ask, did they ever find the man who did this to you?
They did. They caught him about 3 months later in Alabama.
Yep. Really? Wow. Yep. How did they do that?
Due to the fight with me getting the knife, he was stabbed and he cut himself coming into the home. So he left a blood trail down the streets with DNA and fingerprint evidence. And he was already in the system. So when they were able to run those things, they knew the name, and it just took them 3 months to find him.
My goodness. And his motivation was money and a car.
Yeah. He just had struggled with drugs and he ran out of money and broke into the house just trying to get some money for that next fix.
I'm so sorry. So sorry. Can we go to the place where once you realized you had not only trauma to sort through, but an evil against you that you needed to forgive? Because I keep thinking of people listening today who I hear from a lot of our listeners, and maybe they've not walked through anything like this, but there are hurts enough that have impacted them and they feel stuck. So I want to make sure that they hear from you the stuff that God has imparted to you. But we've got to hear this part of your story. Talk about just the aftermath and how you sorted it through and how you came to forgive.
Yeah, it was forgiveness was, didn't know much about it other than knew I was supposed to do it. as laying in the hospital room, I realized that, you know, just my whole life was shattered. I didn't know if I would ever go back to pastoring or preaching, because I didn't know if I could tell people that they could trust God, because I didn't know if I could trust God because of what took place. And through a series of miraculous events, God really showed me that when I thought he was the farthest from me, he actually was closer than I could have ever imagined. And God kind of helped me see that. But then there's, I think oftentimes what happens is we think forgiveness is just about forgiving a person, or sometimes forgiving them for what they did. Like in this case, this man, you know, broke in the house and nearly murdered me. But what I discovered, I quickly forgave him and forgave him for what he did in the hospital room. And that was really out of obedience. And I just felt like, you know, I knew when I was in the hospital room, it was amazing how I wasn't thinking about all that he did to me, I went back to how in 1990, God rescued me from my, as an 18-year-old teenager, from a path that I was going down of just drinking and partying and using drugs and fighting and all that type of stuff, and how God saved me and how he had forgiven me of so much, from years of addiction to pornography and just anger and all these different, my own experience of salvation and just how God has constantly forgiven me in the hospital room. That really became the foundation for my forgiveness of this man and what he did, was just how much God really had forgiven me. That was the, what was chief on my mind. And then, but what I didn't expect was, as life began going, days became weeks and weeks became months, how there was this ripple effect of the impact that this guy had on my life. And again, like you described, how, you know, with the impact on my kids, my wife, we went bankrupt. We lost everything. So for 7 years, we're here now getting rejected for a home, you know, to rent a home now, for that matter, because we have bankruptcy. You know, there was always these moments that would come up, and I would have this opportunity to do one of two things. I either start fighting to forgive him again at that moment for this impact, or that impact would almost serve as a trigger to go, make me go all the way back to square one, where I was stuck for so many years. And that's where I really began to go through. So the impact was just, it was so far reaching. And I think that's what oftentimes what I've discovered, my own personal experience, but even walking with so many other people, usually it's the impact is what people get stuck at. It's the feelings, the emotions, the new life that they're, the unknowns, the fears, all of those things in our head that keep them from being able to fully let go. And that was really my fight. That's why I always talk about, sometimes people talk about forgiveness as a process. It's a nice journey. I'm like, nope, it's a fight.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That's where I really kind of came up with that. And that really described what we had to walk through.
Wow. When did you get your first glimpses of you're going to be okay, your family's going to be okay, healing is coming? And how did that happen?
That's a great question. I think the turning point for me came about almost 3 years later. And that was when it came to, there was the closure moment of our court case. And what happened there was, there comes the moment where you give a victim impact statement. The man had decided to take a plea and pled guilty. And so now we're just going through the final thing where I'm supposed to go in there and basically now bring up all the old wounds. I'm supposed to go in there and say, this is what he did, this is how I felt, this is what he created. And I refused to do that. And I said, I'm not going to give a victim statement, but I'll give a life statement. And that really came from the life of Joseph that I saw. Wow. It began walking through a study of Joseph and just forgiveness and trauma in the Bible, and began looking at all these various instances and stories to try to get a grasp of, how did God lead people through those moments? How did he bring them out? How did they come out better than maybe they even started? And Joseph, obviously, I grabbed hold of his story. And so in Genesis 45, when he comes face to face with his brothers, I didn't hear him speaking as a victim. I just saw something totally different. So I gave a life statement where I ended up putting God in the center of my story instead of making my attacker the center of my story.
Wow.
Or my pain. Center my story, or the hurt, or my fears, or my anxiety, or all the unknowns. Instead of speaking from that place, I put God in the center, and I shared how God changed me and how God caused me to see just the value of my priorities and the importance of them. And I made a lot of changes to my life based on just this, what the enemy obviously meant for evil in this moment. It became a moment of change. I had a phone call with John Ortberg, and he described me when I was walking through this process, and he said, Kevin, the greatest enemy you can face, or the worst thing you can do right now, is get back on the treadmill of life. And if you get back on the treadmill, you're just going to start running again, going nowhere. He goes, don't get back on the treadmill. God has given you through this traumatic event a gift, and that gift is the ability to change. And that really sparked something in me and really kind of helped me. And that's where I shared with my attacker that, you know, I had forgiven him and that, you know, I would be there for him if he ever needed a friend or wanted to reach out. Wow. And that's where
did you get any kind of sense he was moved by what you were saying, or did he have death in his eyes?
No, at that moment he was still fighting because, you know, he didn't agree with some of the charges. He didn't agree with the charge of intent to murder.
Wow. Okay.
He took it in the form of, I didn't break in with intentions of murdering. He didn't, you know, so, I mean, and we've emailed now back and forth and have corresponded for 12 years.
Oh,
and
wow.
There was one point where he brought that up again, how he didn't. And my response was, so when you were stabbing me 37 times and you weren't intending to kill me, were you trying to tickle me? but there were certain things that I think he got fixated on. But over the time, I know he has genuinely repented. He is very sorry. He's expressed that he wished more than anything that we could have met on normal terms because he felt, you know, that we could have become friends or I could have been someone that could have really helped him in life.
Is he doing life in prison right now?
Nope. He got sentenced 18 to 40 years in prison. So he actually will be eligible for parole coming up here in the next 7 years, actually.
Wow. Wow. And your email back and forth, you know, it's such a, to me, if him splitting hairs about saying I didn't break in with the intent, but he had a full intent to murder you. But for him to grab at that little straw, doesn't that just kind of, that's what it looks like when we're trying to find our own righteousness, just in the greater scheme of things. Don't you think that when we refuse to fall on the grace of God and swim in the mercy of God, we're trying so hard to find like, okay, I might have done those things wrong, but I didn't mean it this way. And we justify the dumbest things, really, when sin is death, no matter how you look at it. But I don't know, that just struck me. I think that's such a picture of what we in our own flesh do. We justify things when we're not relying on his grace and mercy, you know?
Yep. And in that moment, too, when he brings up that stuff, even if it's 6 and 7 years later, it's a moment of offense again for me.
Yeah, and I bet.
What happens is I have a choice at that moment again. I have to now, once again, determine, am I going to pick up this offense again, or go all the way back to, or you let it be a trigger that makes me go all the way back to day one again. Or at that moment, I choose to forgive. And forgiveness is never a one-time decision. It's a life decision.
Indeed. Wow. Was it hard for your wife and kids for you to develop a relationship with him?
I've kept a lot of it private. My wife, I keep my wife in tune with a lot of it, and the kids are aware of some of it, but I don't go into great details because I protect them. Because there has been moments in our correspondence where, you know, I'm very truthful. I'm very blunt. He will say certain things, and it hasn't been, I wouldn't say like it's a warm relationship between us. It has been a challenging relationship. And part of it is because we never knew each other outside of this night. So we didn't have history. Our relationship was forged and formed on this traumatic event. So we're trying to understand but getting to hear his story, knowing a little bit more of his upbringing, those are the things that I've shared with my family, because I want them to understand that this man, it's not that he woke up saying, I want to go kill someone today, or I want to try to do this. I mean, he had a lot of pain in his life, a lot of trauma in his life that he had never been able to experience. Healing has been undealt with, and it has led him down a path that, it's not an excuse for what he's done, but it's a very real reality. And so I share a little bit of those details because I want them not to walk through life with this label of looking at people of this is the way they are, or just judging them based on one moment in time or one traumatic event or one choice. There's a lot more to people than just those decisions.
Indeed. I'm going to break here. When we come back, I want to walk through just 5 points, if we can get through them all, about just sort of the process of how you walk through forgiveness for somebody. I think this will help you today if you're listening and wondering and feeling like this is poking at some things in you that you're holding on to, maybe a much lesser offense, and yet you're still holding a grudge. You remember what my friend Melissa Coleman has said on the show several times. You hear it, hurt people, but healed people heal people. And as believers, we've got to somehow go after our healing. That's why I talk about it so much on the show, whether it's physical, emotional, that, you know, we've got to resolve the traumas in light of God's love and faithfulness so the enemy has no more access to those spots and places in us, and we can start to help others heal. More with Kevin Ramsby in a minute. If you listen to me often enough, you know I believe in the power of prayer. The Bible says the prayer of the righteous accomplishes great and powerful things. I am passionate about prayer, and we all need it, and we would love to pray for you. The Faith Radio team, we're serious about prayer, and we pray for specific listener requests every single week. So if you have a request, if you're walking through a difficult time, you can share your prayer request with us anonymously and securely on our website at myfaithradio.com. Thanks so much for tuning in to Suzy Larson Live, talking to Kevin Ramsby. He served as an executive pastor in the inner city of Detroit. One night when his wife and kids were out of town visiting her parents, he was attacked by an intruder who was invading the home, stabbed him 37 times, leaving him for dead. And at one point, when the attacker was up rummaging through one of their rooms looking for money, he was pulled himself up together, fell apart on the neighbor's porch, bleeding, almost dead, and they called 911, and his life has been saved. Before we walk through these points, we only have about 7 minutes left, so I have so much I want to accomplish before this we end here today. But how is your body now? Like, how are your fingers where you severed the tendons, and your spine where you were stabbed in the neck, and your gut with your intestines? I mean, how is your body?
It's remarkably does well. I mean, my hands have damage where two fingers that I don't have a lot of feeling, so my thumb, and I don't have a lot of usage and not a lot of feeling in a couple of my fingers, and just the wounds to my abdomen area. So I don't get to do a lot of core workouts these days.
Do you digest okay?
Yeah. Well, that was part of the miracle. Stabbed 37 times, but every vital organ was missed. I mean,
wow.
I mean, from the jugular to when the wound in my abdomen to the spine, it just, they were amazed. They called that was a miracle in itself. Wow. Just they've seen. So, yeah.
Wow. Well, thanks for that update. Okay, so I want to read these just because in case we run out of time. As you help people heal, and you've got a whole ministry to help people sort through trauma. The first point is revealing the wrongs, where you name the attack or whatever happened. Two is acknowledging the hurts. You acknowledge the wounds. You take inventory. Three, you trust God. And he calls that God on trial, where you sort through. Maybe you have disappointment with God. He could have intervened. Why didn't he? Letting it go, fighting to forgive. And fifth, discovering God's purpose, and that is the power of forgiveness. How did you sort through with God? I love that you're saying you've already, in hindsight, seeing these miracles of things that God did. But how did you get to that point where you realized, okay, He allowed this, but he is redeeming it.
Yeah. Part of it was experiential in the sense of, you know, when you find out that there was no bloody footprints or blood evidence when you left the kitchen to the neighbor's porch, and there's these, how my family was supposed to be there, they're not. So part of it experiential was, again, I felt this way. But sometimes feelings are not the best way to make decisions and come to conclusions. Mm-hmm. And so I had a people outside of my pain that also helped me see these things. So part of it was other people around you can help me discover that, man, this is what you felt, but look at what God did. And so surrounding yourself with those right people was such a huge part of it. I think that was one of the main things.
Boy, that is so good. When you talk about trusting God and God on trial, talk about that. When you're helping people sort through, God could have intervened. He didn't. But you're, as you say, as you sort through the story, you always will find that he was present. He was closer than you imagined. And but how do you help people walk that process?
Really, what I do is, after this course, or after all this event, when I struggled with trusting God, one of the things I did, all of our stories, you know, there's these moments in life that you can't go back, you can't undo them. But there are these moments where God's faithfulness showed up, his provision showed up, his care showed up. And so for me, I went through like an exercise where I call them faith markers. And what I did is I went all the way back to my salvation experience. But there was about 12 moments where God had just really shown himself faithful and just so present and so real. And so what I do to help people understand how to retrust God, I start going backwards to help them kind of discover and rediscover, in a sense, how God's always been faithful there. And so what happens is when you can chart out these faith markers in your story, in your life, where God was, he was so faithful. For me, what it becomes when you're struggling to keep forgiving, you're going to have to go backwards and past God's faithfulness in your story to get back to that fence. And really it came through that for me is when Joshua, those stones that they took out of the center and before they built this memorial out before Jericho, I thought it was ironic that they didn't put the memorial right at the miracle moment, but they planted it. They carried those rocks for, I believe it's 7 miles, and they built this memorial 2 miles in front of Jericho. And I think it was symbolic of, you're going to face an enemy ahead. And when you do, you're going to be tempted to go backwards. But to go backwards, you're going to have to pass and walk by God's faithfulness in your story. So I help people kind of revisit those moments in their lives, rediscover them.
Wow, so good. Did you ever deal with fear, like a fear that you didn't have before that event in the days, years that followed?
Fear was probably my number one enemy for a long time. And it wasn't, I mean, initially it was obviously fear that the guy would come back when he was on the run for those months. And then there was the fear that something bad could happen again. But then I think the fear that came, I really began getting crippled by a fear of the unknowns, in a sense of that, what if something is broken in me that I don't see? And I began to, you know, or fear that, because this happened, I've now missed out on what God could have done or what God was doing. Mm. And almost as we were in such a great moment, and then the surprise attack takes place. And then you just wonder, is it possible to really get back to a place where God is just fully in charge and you're experiencing and walking in God's faithfulness and his fruitfulness and joy again?
Would you say you're there now with your wife and kids? I mean, do you feel like you find yourself in a place of redemption? You still wrestling through a lot of things, or how would you describe where you're at right now?
100%. I feel like we've come in. I always talk to people when they're dealing with forgiveness and overcoming trauma, the end result, what is the goal? Where do you want to get to? And I think it's to get to the place where the person and the event that has taken place, they're no longer influencing or impacting you negatively. And so for me, it's what Paul says, forgetting what's behind. It's not an absence of memory. I can recall everything that's happened, but it no longer has this impact, or it's no longer influencing me or my family. As a matter of fact, it's the Genesis 50:20, when Joseph, you know, 49 years after his betrayal of his brothers and everything he's went through, he says, "You meant it for evil, but God intended for good for what's happening today." And I think there becomes a moment, a defining moment, where you'll be able to look back and you look at your today and you go, wow, God has led me to this place. And now it's being used for greater good and for greater purposes. And so, you know, for me to be able to go, we're going 3 weeks. We go to Texas Death Row to minister and share our seminars with inmates that have done the most horrific crimes you can imagine, but they have accepted Christ, and now we're walking them through not only forgiving the people who have hurt them in their lives, but also learning to forgive themselves, in a sense.
Wow. Wow. I'm just so speechless. I'm so grateful you joined us today, Kevin. Thank you for the way you're stewarding your story. God is so faithful, and I pray he continues to overwhelm you with his goodness and use you beyond your wildest dreams. Thank you. Thank you for joining us today.
Much.
So good. Kevin Ramsby is his name. His book, Fight to Forgive. We got a handful of copies to give away. You can text the word book if you want in on the drawing. 877-933-2484. I love that he calls it a fight to forgive. I think we do have to contend for this faith because we have a real enemy. So let's contend and let's do it together. I'll meet you back here next time. Thanks for listening to Suzy Larson Live. Podcasts like mine are available because of your support. If it's important to you to hear things that encourage your faith, click the link in the show notes and give now.